These Days.
Kids These Days.
This is Kids These Days.
Today on the program, we're learning about postpartum mood disorders, like postpartum depression. Women everywhere are at risk of developing these conditions after they give birth. And there's good reason to be aware that depression, beyond the baby blues, can be a serious concern. We have national and statewide experts in the studio with us today. We'll talk with an author who wrote about her postpartum depression experience and hear from an Alaskan dad who helped his wife through it. Plus, parents tell KTD how they take good care of themselves. That and more on today's Kids These Days. Many new moms experience what are called the baby blues, but when does teariness and being emotional go from normal into something to worry about? We'll find out more about that this hour. But first, have you experienced postpartum depression? Are you home with an infant feeling desperate right now? We want to hear your story, and you can share it with us online. Go to kidsthesedays.org and leave a comment or find our page on Facebook and write to us there. Kids These Days tries to link Alaskans to each other and to help us all feel more connected. And with me in the studio to talk about this issue today is Margie Clifford. Margie is a licensed professional counselor and yoga teacher based in Anchorage. As statewide coordinator for the Postpartum Support International, she helps pregnant and postpartum women and their families find ways to thrive. Margie runs the Family Support Counseling Clinic at the Children's Hospital at Providence Hospital in Anchorage. Thanks to you, Margie, for being with us today.
Thanks, my pleasure.
And on the phone, we have Dr. Diana Lynn Barnes joining the conversation. Dr. Barnes is an internationally recognized expert in the assessment and treatment of perinatal mood disorders. She's the author of The Journey to Parenthood, Myths, Reality, and What Really Matters. She's also involved with Postpartum Support International. She is a past president and currently sits on the president's on its President's Advisory Council. She's the co-founder of the Motherhood Consortium, a Southern California-based working group that brings together professionals who work with mothers and babies to discuss the most relevant issues in their field. Diana is a doctor of psychology and a licensed family therapist. She joins us today from Los Angeles, California. And thanks to you, Diana, for being with us.
Oh, it's my pleasure. I'm glad to be here.
Well, while researching this issue before today's conversation, I have to say learning some of the historical information about postpartum depression and what's been known or believed about it was of particular interest to me. And Dr. Barnes, I'm wondering if you could begin the conversation by telling us a little bit about the history of postpartum depression and perinatal mood disorders and awareness of them throughout time.
Well, I think we can go back as far as Hippocrates. We know that women were experiencing mood disorders even back then. But, you know, our attitudes and our ideas about mental health have been slowly changing. We're still working on reducing the stigma about mental illnesses, but it has been slowly changing over time. And I know certainly in the 40s, perhaps, 30s, 40s, 50s, women who were experiencing depression were said to have had the blues. And the blues was kind of the umbrella term for any kind of not feeling good, discontent, teariness, mood changes that occurred around this time of pregnancy and childbirth. As we've become more knowledgeable, and I think sadly, but the tragic case of Andrea Yates, who most people are familiar with, the woman in Houston, Texas, who drowned her five children in 2001, really opened the door to people wanting to know much more about this illness and what causes it, what are the risk factors. So I think we've come a long way since the days when people with mental illness were put out to sea or taken to the top of a mountain and chained to a rock.
Mm-hmm. And you know, your reference to Andrea Yates and 2001, that's just not really a long time ago. It's only 10 years ago that I would say from my own experience that perinatal mood disorders is even something that I was aware of as a woman.
Yes, yes. And I think, you know, I think it is important, though, since I did bring up Andrea Yates, I think it's so critical that we draw a distinction, and a very clear distinction, between postpartum depression and postpartum psychosis.
Okay.
Because what Andrea Yates was experiencing was psychosis. And too often that gets lumped under the different ways in which postpartum depression can present itself, when actually postpartum psychosis is its own very special category of illness.
And I would like to talk about those categories of illness as well. We talk about perinatal mood disorders, and we also talk about postpartum disorders. First of all, I'm curious about those two words. They seem to be used somewhat interchangeably. Are they interchangeable, perinatal and postpartum?
Well, actually, perinatal refers to the period of time between conception and the first year postpartum.
Okay.
That's considered the perinatal period. The postpartum period is considered that period of time between the birth, the actual birth of the child, and the first year postpartum. You know, it's interesting because there have been so many myths that float around over the years about motherhood. We have a lot of societal values about pregnancy, about childbearing, how women are supposed to feel, how women are supposed to act. And one of those myths has to do with pregnancy, that women are blissful during this time, that they never felt better during this time, that they're glowing. We have, you know, these images, these pictures of women in this kind of euphoric state during their pregnancies, and yet we actually know that about 10% of women are going to experience some kind of perinatal mood or anxiety disorder during their pregnancies, which is quite stunning.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. And I think that we should definitely get back to that, too, when we talk about some of the triggers and so forth that might be ones to watch for, or indicators that might be ones to watch for. I want to get back to that idea of the categories of illness, of the different types of illness. There's a distinction between postpartum depression and postpartum psychosis, for example. So, Margie, maybe that's something that you can jump into the conversation and tell us about. What is that span of different sorts of mood disorders that can happen during this period?
Well, even depression during the postpartum period, and I really use the term perinatal most often, because okay, so often the disorders that are exacerbated postpartum, we see the first symptoms of during pregnancy. So it really is helpful for women to understand that it is the physical and emotional and mental health changes that happen during that whole transition to pregnancy and to parenting that really can sometimes use some additional support. So depression is quite common. The baby blues, like you mentioned, Shanna, we see upwards of 80% of all moms experiencing at least a couple of days worth of some unusual, maybe emotional patterning, where they're maybe more tearful than usual, maybe more irritable. But the baby blues tends to resolve on its own. And when moms know it's coming, when they know to expect it, it tends not to cause too much distress. A couple days of extra TLC, and it will resolve on its own. For a smaller percentage, like Dr. Barnes referenced, there are symptoms that either because of their severity or their duration probably aren't going to resolve on their own. And the earlier that women can get help for those symptoms, the more quickly they will recover. So it's not just the sadness that we tend to identify with depression, but certainly sadness and lack of interest, lack of pleasure in doing things that are usually pleasurable. Those are kind of the big hallmarks of depression. But there's also a preponderance of anxiety in the postpartum period, and you can understand that. And I really believe that most of these instincts are healthy ones. Given the right conditions, they will lead to strong families. You know, we expect and we want parents to be a little extra vigilant once their kids are born. So the problem then becomes when that vigilance interferes with a parent's ability to function on their own. So a parent who can't sleep when their baby is sleeping is going to be a real problem the next day. So there are the anxiety disorders, and then panic disorder. So anxiety, excuse me, anxiety to the point that there's a real physical panic attack is possible during this period. And also another relatively common disorder that we see postpartum is postpartum obsessive compulsive disorder. And people might be familiar with OCD. I think it's in pop culture quite a bit. But obsessive thoughts, repetitive, intrusive thoughts, and then compulsions. So things that you feel like you need to do in order for the world to be at ease and the world to be well. So, you know, some of the classic ones there, the hand washing or checking the stove, those kinds of things. And again, those are healthy instincts. We do want people to be vigilant about cleanliness and to wash their hands when they're taking care of their babies. And at what point, though, there can be sort of a fine line as to what point that becomes a disorder. And I really help families to find that line where they're experiencing distress. And the psychosis that Dr. Barnes referenced, it's important to make a distinction too, that there may be a mom, and there are lots of moms out there, who have disturbing thoughts about hurting their babies or about their babies getting hurt, who are horrified by these ideas. They know that that's not what they would do, nor what they want to do. But they hear stories about Andrea Yates and other women who have committed infanticide, and they worry that that could be them. And it's really important to know that there are distinct disorders, that a mom with OCD is not going to hurt her baby, and we know that. And it's important for that mom to talk to a professional who's going to help her to mm-hmm. understand that.
Well, the conversation today on Kids These Days is about perinatal mood disorders, and we have with us Dr. Diana Lynn Barnes on the phone from Los Angeles and Margie Clifford, who's here with me in our Anchorage studio, and I'm Shanna Sheehy. And I think it's important at this time to hear the voice of a mom who has experienced postpartum depression as we go through our conversation today. It's hard to remember a time when Google, Facebook, or Wikipedia weren't at the ready to supply us with information and to connect us with others. These days, we can look up any ailment or join a support group just by using our smartphones. But a few years ago, when Susan Kushner-Resnick was experiencing symptoms of postpartum depression, she couldn't find anyone who'd been through it and who'd survived to tell their story. So after she survived PPD, she wrote a memoir about her experience to let others know that it gets better. Here's our producer, Sarah Gonzalez, talking with the author.
Susan, thank you so much for talking to us on Kids These Days.
Oh, thanks for having me.
You wrote a book called Sleepless Days, and it's subtitled One Woman's Journey Through Postpartum Depression. Now, this is a memoir that you wrote after your struggle with postpartum depression. Can you explain the title?
Well, it's called Sleepless Days because one of my worst symptoms of postpartum depression was insomnia. And it was after I had gone for several days without getting any sleep that I realized I had a problem and needed help. And so they just felt like sleepless days, like it just every day continued and never stopped. And sleepless nights is kind of a common title and saying, but sleepless days was a little twist on that.
Why did you feel like you needed to write a book about your experience?
Well, at the time, and I wrote my book about 10 years ago, although women are still obviously having postpartum depression. It was the first one written by an American. There wasn't a book like this out there, and I needed to read it. So while I was trying to find a book to comfort myself and realized there wasn't one, I was taking notes on what was going on because I had been a journalist for a long time. And somewhere in my addled mind, I knew that I had some good material. So I would take these notes and type them up, and when I was better, I could then just write the book.
Your bout with postpartum depression occurred after the birth of your second child. Is that correct?
Yes.
And how can you describe for us who maybe don't know how you know that you have it? How does it come on? And I mean, in those days after having a baby, you're exhausted anyway. So can you describe what it was that led you to know that you were dealing with something beyond the baby blues?
Well, because of that exhaustion, it took me about 4 months after his birth to realize something serious was wrong, because I thought I wasn't sleeping due to him not sleeping. And then when he started to sleep through the night and I was still bouncing off the walls pretty much, I realized something was wrong. But when I look back on it after I recovered, I realized that as soon as hours after he was born in the hospital, as I write in my book, I was cleaning the room, I mean, straightening up the room. And we hadn't picked a middle name for him, and I started obsessing about middle names. So I think it happened almost immediately, but it took me those 4 months to realize this is not normal.
And in your book, you mentioned a few times that the thought of there being a light at the end of the tunnel was just unimaginable to you when you were experiencing postpartum depression. What does it feel like to be caring for an infant in a family and recovering from a delivery and also experiencing this depression? Can you describe like just a day?
Well, for me, it was more anxiety than depression. I mean, I didn't feel like I couldn't get out of bed. Postpartum depression is sort of a term that covers it all, but it was more like postpartum anxiety. So I was having these huge anxiety attacks all the time for no reason, just sitting at my table, and I'd get anxious. So my days, I was very functional. Nobody knew that this was going on. And I just was making everything happen and holding on for dear life, it felt like, because I thought incorrectly that if I admitted I was having trouble taking care of my children or having any problems, that somebody would take my kids away. So, you know, there's a lot of unrealistic thinking going on.
And how were you able to get treatment for yourself or support for yourself while you were going through this?
Well, when I realized something was wrong and that this, you know, being up all night for days really wasn't how it's supposed to go, I contacted the people I had rented my breast pump from because I really didn't know who to talk to. When I had seen my OB for my 6-week checkup, I was fine compared to how I was 4 months later. It was nothing that she could detect. So I contacted these breast pump people, and as soon as they heard my story, they said, oh, you have postpartum depression. Let me give you some names. And that led me to find a great nurse practitioner who was also a therapist. As soon as she heard what was going on, she said, can you come in tomorrow? And I thought, wow, she doesn't have a lot of patience if she can see me so soon. But she actually could tell what bad shape I was in. She, you know, we did some counseling, and she gave me first some medication just to help me sleep. And then we talked about putting me on antidepressants, and I resisted that for a really long time, and which was, you know, in retrospect, really foolish, because as soon as I finally gave into it, I got better so quickly that it was clear it was really a chemical, biological thing that could be cured with medication.
Okay, and then when it started to lift, what sorts of things did you notice about yourself or about your situation, maybe in hindsight, after you were able to start recovering?
Well, I could sleep again, and I felt more connected to my children, and I could talk to people about it. I wasn't in denial anymore, and I also wasn't counting the hours of the days. When it was really bad, I would just count the hours waiting for my husband to come home and then count the hours waiting to go to bed, but then I wouldn't sleep. So there was a lot of counting. So the counting stopped.
Susan, you said earlier that one of the reasons for writing this memoir was that there wasn't anything else like it, and you were maybe searching for another story like your own. Where do you think the need came from for you to identify with someone else or have someone identify with you?
I think I just wanted to feel comforted in that I wasn't alone and to actually get the fact that somebody had survived this. It just felt so strange going through it and not knowing what the end result would be. So in writing the book, I kind of wanted to give that to other women. You know, I start the book saying it's temporary, and I want people to know that as bad as it feels, it definitely goes away.
What do relatives and friends need to know about helping someone who they think might be suffering from postpartum depression?
Well, they need to know that women who have PPD are often in denial. So it's really frustrating. You know, you might say to this woman, something's wrong, I think you should get help. And she'll say, no, absolutely not, I'm fine. In fact, the more they deny it, the more that's an indication that something is wrong, if they're not even willing to explore the possibility that they're depressed. And, you know, just tell the woman there's no shame in it. It's not a character flaw. It doesn't mean she's a bad mother. It's just a chemical thing.
Susan, what would you tell women who are in it right now?
don't be ashamed and ask for help. Ask your OB, ask a regular doctor, your pediatrician, just, you know, get some help because it'll be better for you and better for your kids.
It gets better.
Oh, it absolutely gets better. It gets better. You have a wonderful relationship with your child, and you can just move on with life.
That's great. Susan, thank you so much for sharing your story with us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
You can read an excerpt from Susan Kushner-Resnick's book, Sleepless Days, One Woman's Journey Through Postpartum Depression, by visiting kidsthesedays.org. I'm Shanna Sheehy. This is Kids These Days. And I'm in the studio today with Margie Clifford and Dr. Diana Lynn Barnes, and we're talking about perinatal mood disorders. And Dr. Barnes, after hearing Susan Kushner-Resnick talking about her experience, having PPD and then finally ultimately seeking help and then getting well, is her experience and your experience one that many women have?
Well, we know that postpartum anxiety is among the most common ways in which postpartum symptoms present themselves. About 15 to 20% of women are going to be experiencing this really overwhelming, paralyzing, immobilizing anxiety, and very often it's the cry of the baby that is the trigger for this. And it's, I think it's important to also to emphasize that it's not that women don't want to go to their babies, it's that they can't. It's the illness has paralyzed them to the extent where they literally cannot move. The anxiety attacks are excruciating. And I know that because in the first year of my daughter's life, I was hospitalized 4 different times with extended hospitalizations of 2 to 3 weeks at a time. And I had very severe postpartum depression with anxiety. And no one knew at that time, that goes back 19 years, nobody knew at that time what was happening to me. And it took a year before I even heard the word postpartum depression.
And how?
And it was something...
I'm sorry. I'm just curious. How were you treated in those hospitalizations? Like, were you given antidepressants, or you know, how was it that at that time, 19 years ago, they tried to help you?
Well, over the course of a year, there were all different kinds of treatments, whether it was medication related, therapy related, and because no one was really knowledgeable about what was happening to me, none of these treatments really worked. And we know today that the best prognosis for treatment is a combination of antidepressant medication, possibly sleep medication, as Susan mentioned, along with supportive psychotherapy and the different therapeutic models that are used. One of the things that also struck me, and I thought back, and Margie will understand this, because PSI has a universal message that we offer women, and that universal message is you're not alone. You know, you're not to blame. You didn't do anything to cause this, because so often women feel at fault. They feel somehow that it is a character flaw, some kind of personality limitation that has created all of this. And we also want women to know that with help, they'll get well. These are very, very treatable conditions, very treatable conditions, and but they need to be treated.
And I'll mention the PSI is Postpartum Support International. You know, I heard in Susan's speaking about her experiences, this idea that, you know, just knowing that other people have experienced postpartum depression and that they have become well, that they've gotten well, is a real comfort to women who are going through it. And Postpartum Support International, is that part of what PSI does, is offer that, hey, we've been there with you before kind of feeling for folks?
Yeah, you know, the most important efforts that Postpartum Support International makes worldwide is to strengthen support networks around parenting, around moms. And, you know, We have one group here in Anchorage that meets at the Children's Hospital at Providence on Monday afternoons at 2 o'clock. It's a postpartum support group. And I think that that first part of the postpartum support international message that Dr. Barnes just referenced, that you are not alone, is so crucial for women. And in fact, we know that having a poor social support system is one of the highest risk factors for the development of these disorders, and that strengthening a support system is one of the best treatments. This idea of a woman having to go through this alone, go through even, you know, the effort of recovering physically postpartum, and caring for her baby alone is unrealistic, and it results many times in disorder that that really does need treatment. I think an important part of Sarah's story that we heard there was how well she sounds, how she recovered. And I think that we need to reiterate that she did recover and she is well because she did get treatment. She needed help, she got help, and now she's well.
And is it possible, do women recover without intervention? Maybe that's very complex and it depends on the individual, but I'm just wondering about that. Like if someone doesn't get the help that is available, you know, what's the outlook for that woman? Dr. Barnes, maybe you could answer that.
Yeah, sure. I'd be happy to jump in here. Sometimes actually the illness will remit on its own and the symptoms will diminish. Sometimes that will occur. However, what's problematic with that is that once the brain chemistry has been dysregulated by one depressive episode, mm-hmm. the next time that a woman gets pregnant, she's at about a 75% chance of a recurrence in a subsequent pregnancy and an even more severe recurrence because the brain kind of remembers where it's been, mm-hmm. And it becomes much more, the chemistry becomes much more vulnerable to stress, and pregnancy and childbirth is certainly a major stress in a woman's life. So that's why we emphasize early intervention, early treatment, because these disorders are so treatable, and it actually, by putting a treatment plan in place, we now know that we can actually avert, in many cases, the symptoms from emerging. And if we can't do that, we can at the very least diminish the intensity of those symptoms.
And before we have to take a quick break, I want to know what are some of the risk factors that a woman might have during pregnancy or before pregnancy that might contribute to the developing of postpartum depression?
Well, we want to look at her biological vulnerability. So we want to look at family history. Is this a woman who has a personal or family history of some kind of mood or anxiety disorder? We know in psychosis that this is actually a bipolar episode with psychotic features. So we want to know if a woman has a personal or family history of bipolar disorder or schizophrenia. We want to know what some of the psychosocial stressors are in her environment. Are there financial stressors? As Margie said, is there an absence of social support? So important to the new mom. We want to look at, you know, have there been losses in this woman's life that may be contributing to the current depression? Has there been trauma, early trauma, that is now being reactivated by the birth of this child? And we also want to look at psychological factors, things like a woman's early relationship with her own mother, because we know that that earliest attachment experience comes flying to the surface when women give birth, and particularly when a woman gives birth to her own female child. So there are so many things that we want to be looking at, and our understanding of postpartum or perinatal mood disorders now, currently, is that we have to look at this compilation of factors, that this is not just hormones gone wild. If it was just that, then every woman who gave birth would have, you know, a postpartum depressive episode, and that's certainly not the case.
Mm-hmm. Well, you're listening to Kids These Days on this listener-supported station. Kids These Days is an independent production of the Content Producers Guild. We produce this show in partnership with KSKA-FM in Anchorage, Alaska. I'm Shanna Sheehy, and I'll be back in the second half of the program to talk more with Margie Clifford and Dr. Diana Lynn Barnes about perinatal mood disorders like postpartum depression. Also still coming this hour, we hear one Alaskan dad talk about postpartum depression from his point of view. Stay with us.
Isn't very difficult to see why you are the way you are. Doesn't take a genius to realize that sometimes life is hard. It's gonna take time.
Next time on Kids These Days, we're spending the hour exploring gifted and talented education. We'll examine some of the hot topics and myths associated with educating gifted kids. Plus, are gifted and talented programs endangered? And why telling kids that they're smart might actually be harmful to their future success? Join us next time on Kids These Days for all this and more. You're tuned into Kids These Days on your public radio station, and today our conversation is about the mood disorders many women experience after they give birth. I'm Shanna Sheehy, and Dr. Diana Lynn Barnes and Margie Clifford join me today for that discussion. Margie, you are the statewide coordinator for Postpartum Support International in Alaska, and you also are involved with a family and children's clinic at Providence. And I'm curious about how the whole family is affected by perinatal mood disorders from your perspective through the work you do.
Wow. Well, yeah, the whole family, of course, is affected by the journey to parenthood and by the introduction of a new baby into a household where there might already be some kids there. You know, with a newborn, we know, and you mentioned earlier that the importance of that early attachment. We know that a newborn has crucially needs interaction with other people. So a newborn needs to be held, to be talked to be looked at. And so don't we all as well. You know, I often say to my patients that, you know, the baby who we start out as, we don't lose as we grow up. That baby is still within us. And those basic needs that we had when we were newborns, we still have now as adults. But to recognize that the whole family has those needs and to really see the whole family as a system with a capacity for care, and then to look at where the allocation of the resources, the energetic resources that that family has are spent in order for the system to work efficiently. And I know that that doesn't sound very romantic or emotional, but it truly is the kind of objectivity that I think we can use to help families function, to help individuals function as well as they can. And I really like to make the distinction you asked, you know, you asked earlier about can these disorders resolve on their own. And I really make a distinction between a family's ability to survive, to get through things, to get through crises, and then their ability to thrive and really be each individual be fulfilled. And then the interactions in the family, the interactions within the family to be fulfilling for those members. And when there's a breakdown anywhere there, when any member of that family is not having their basic needs met, like when mom isn't sleeping, or for example, you know, if dad isn't eating, or if little sister is not getting enough hugs, you know, all of those things need to be considered for the whole family system to really thrive. And the newborn's needs are certainly apparent, you know, their demands are high. But it's really important for families, I think, to have a bit of an objective perspective on how those babies' needs are going to be met without sacrificing the basic needs requirements of the rest of the family as well. Otherwise, any or all in that system are going to suffer.
And so when mom is suffering from a postpartum mood disorder, perinatal mood disorder, and when she is unable to do the things that maybe she wants to do to care for an infant, I mean, this has ripple effects throughout the family, I imagine. Like, what are the roles of, say, the partner, whether it's a dad or somebody else in the relationship, to help support mom? And what are the kinds of things that dad in the scenario I'm talking about does to pick up the slack in those cases?
Feed everybody, tuck everybody in. It really is basic needs. And again, from Sarah's story, I think she really illustrated for us the etiology of her, or the cause of her disorder was really rooted in those sleepless, mm-hmm. you know, behaviorally anyway. There was certainly a biological component as well, but not getting the rest that she needed, not getting the chance to deactivate her nervous system. You know, she was so stressed and so agitated and never got the chance to recover, and that just exacerbated. So that's why, again, that support network is so crucial, because when mom is needing a few days of sleep and not able to make the breakfast, lunch, and dinner, that doesn't mean that the kids and the baby and mom herself don't still need to eat breakfast, lunch, and dinner. So those support people need to be the extra hands, the extra eyes, the extra ears, the extra mouths that are talking to and listening to and looking at and holding and interacting with those other family members. And that's no deficiency on mom's sake. I mean, that is a normal, healthy family system where there are numerous parties who are looking out for the care of the individuals. So that's really what we need support people to recognize, is that it's really basic needs that we need to make sure are met first and foremost. And then certainly there are higher levels of support, whether it's, medication or psychotherapy or support groups. But really, if the basic needs are not met, then the foundation is not strong enough to support the family that it's holding up.
Well, we've been speaking about supporting mothers of infants this hour on Kids These Days, and we've been hearing from mothers who are dealing with postpartum mood disorders. So let's consider dads for a moment. The partners of those experiencing postpartum depression will not only support moms during a very hard time, but they will most likely have to take on more household responsibilities while she heals. In Juneau, Steve Sue Wing and his family recently weathered PPD, and we asked him to share his thoughts.
As an expectant father who made a conscious and educated choice to have a child with my partner, I made calculated preparations. I read printed materials, researched information on the internet, attended a 6-session birth preparation class with my partner, attended a 3-session dad's prenatal class, and even a father's playgroup. Looking back at this 9-month period in our lives, I feel like I was adequately prepared for the birth of our first child and some of the changes in our lives that would happen after it. Our birth defined most of what I had learned about this event. It also quickly introduced me to the darkness I had not taken time to learn about or research, postpartum depression. April 14th, 2008 will be a day I will remember until my death. Around 10 a.m., in the comfort of a hotel room, my partner eased into contractions that soon continued with regularity. At 10:30, I placed a call to the midwife with the details of the activity, and she told me that if we wanted to slowly make our way to the birth center, for comfort, we could. We arrived at 11:15, and it was quickly determined that we were experiencing active labor. I barely had time to get everything unpacked from our vehicle before my partner told me politely that she would like me by her side. The rest of this event flashed before me. In the last stages of labor, there were only 10 pushes before this hot, wet, and crying human being was in my hands. "It's a boy," I shouted, and he immediately urinated on my arm. It was hot, it was part of him, and I was elated. The time was 3:07 p.m., and labor had lasted just over 4.5 hours. Wow, all of that preparation and effort for the birth, and that was it, and here he was. Less than 1 week after our son's birthday, we were challenged with mother's milk supply and our son's needs. We quickly made arrangements to return to Juneau from where we live to meet with a lactation consultant. It was during this appointment that some comments were made by our consultant that opened my eyes to the disorienting and painful fact that my partner was experiencing postpartum depression. It was impossible for me to know then and now where the lines of disappointment about her challenges with breastfeeding stopped and where the postpartum depression began. It was beyond difficult, it was beyond disappointing, and it was one of the hardest things I have ever had to deal with in my 35 years of life. I had no time to research what the symptoms were. I had no time to research what the treatment should be. I just needed to be awake in an hour and a half to help with the next feeding. I had a few father friends that I met with occasionally in the first months of parenthood. We had some family friends that offered their support, but it was only for the basics, meals, errands, and simple other things we needed. Although we were a family in desperate emotional need, I felt like most of my contacts were initiated by me. No father ever reached out to me. The one exception was my own father, who attempted to reach out in his way at an early stage when none of us had a focused picture of what the difficulty and enormity of the challenge was. I needed support for our new family life and for myself attempting to help my partner suffering from postpartum depression, and I had none. I felt like I could not even talk to my partner about what it was she was experiencing without an eruption of tears and the shouts of raw, jagged emotion. I often felt helpless and lost. I never felt like we actively had a specific plan of how to deal with this encompassing challenge, but I know what I attempted to do for her, and we survived. I encouraged mommy time with other moms and girlfriends. I promoted exercise with our son and without. I made it possible for her to nap alone with her dear cat, her first baby. I encouraged her to call and email friends. I kept us busy with events and activities. I shared many of the domestic duties. I shared countless feedings. I told her I loved her and our son. I know all of this helped, but it was not enough. We chose to see a counselor about 3 months after our son's birth. I was tired and my partner was exhausted. I was frustrated and my partner was hopeless. We just needed someone to tell us that we could make it through and direct us to a plan and some resources. It's obvious to me that you two truly do love one another, was the most helpful thing I can remember our counselor saying. I knew that with this love, we could and would make it through this dark season of life. This love is what allows us to make it this far. Again, it is hard to know when my partner eased out of this darkness, but a planned permanent transition to a new life and another town seemed to diminish the depression and move us beyond the first 6 months of our son's life. It was long, disorienting, and draining period. Thankfully, it was a character-building experience for our partnership and me. If you are an expectant father, please take some time to educate yourself about what postpartum depression is and the symptoms. If you are a new father with a partner who is currently experiencing postpartum depression, find a way to patiently help her get the care she needs, and do not be afraid to ask family or friends for support. If you are a family member or friend of a family with a new addition, do not concentrate all of your energies on mom and baby. Dad may need your support too and may have been forgotten in this transitional period.
Look for Steve's weekly contributions to kidsthesedays.org. He'll be writing a brand new blog for us. Look for capital letters, Notes from a Juno Dad, that will appear every Thursday. You're listening to Kids These Days, and we hope that on Kids These Days, the conversation starts here. And we'd love to hear your unique voice. If you have a story to share or a comment to make about today's topic, perinatal mood disorders, we invite you to share it on kidsthesedays.org or by way of our Facebook page. I'm Shanna Sheehy, and I'm in the studio with Margie Clifford, and Dr. Diana Lynn Barnes joins us on the phone from California. Dr. Barnes, after listening to Steve Sue Wing and his thoughts about postpartum depression, I just wonder if you had any reaction to what he said.
Well, yes, I do. I think what he talks about says so clearly that perinatal mood disorders reverberate throughout the family system, that men do have their own experience of what is going on. And I think, you know, sometimes because we expect dads to kind of be in the supportive role, we forget that they are having their own experience, and they could have a range of emotional reactions. Steve talked about frustration, sadness. Sometimes men are just angry. They don't understand what's going on, and the person that they love, that they live with, all of a sudden they don't know who this person is anymore. And so I think it's very important that we include dads in the process here, and particularly when a mom has postpartum depression, that dad is at risk also of becoming depressed by virtue of the fact that his partner is depressed. One of the other things that Steve talked about was not having a plan, and I think his story really emphasizes the need for education, that families need to educate themselves about perinatal mood disorders so that they do have a plan in place. One of the other things about this transition to parenthood is that it does really, we all come to it with our own expectations, and too often couples don't voice their expectations to each other, so they make assumptions about how the other person is going to behave, and too often those assumptions are incorrect. So it's very important that people plan, they communicate, there may need a renegotiation of roles. This is, as Margie said earlier, this is a systemic concern.
You know, when looking around for statistics about perinatal mood disorders, I discovered, and this is through the organization that both of you are associated with, Postpartum Support International, that 1 in 8 women in the U.S. experience postpartum depression. And then we also discovered at Kids These Days some numbers from Providence Hospital here in Anchorage saying that 1 in 4 women experience perinatal mood disorder in Alaska. Margie Clifford?
Yeah, and I can speak to the Alaska statistics. Those numbers are drawn from a study. It's the Pregnancy Risk Assessment Management Survey that Alaska is one of a number of states nationwide. This is a way of looking at risk during pregnancy and postpartum that the Center for Disease Control has actually contrived and has been doing for many years, a couple of decades now. That survey asked two questions about symptoms of maternal depression, and they're asking about those two kind of hallmarks of depression that we mentioned earlier, that sad or depressed mood, and then also the lack of interest or pleasure in doing things. So what they found was that it was nearly 25% of Alaska moms who were sampled in this survey reported symptoms, those two symptoms of depression. And fortunately in Alaska, we have a follow-up survey. Unfortunately, that follow-up survey found that over 50% of moms with two-year-old children still were experiencing those symptoms. So I think that we have a better idea of the incidence of the symptomatic presentation of depression from that survey, but we're also seeing that those symptoms are staying with moms because they're not getting the treatment that they need, or at least many of them aren't. So and the other thing is that I would actually I think that our Alaska numbers actually are a bit higher than that. If you remember, we've mentioned a number of times here the prevalence of anxiety postpartum, and that survey does not ask moms about symptoms of anxiety. So I think that our numbers here in Alaska are probably a little bit higher. Our climate is certainly a factor. The number of folks who are far away from their families of origin, our large military population, where folks are probably new to town or newer to town and have less of an established support system. A lot of these factors contribute to a little bit higher rate, but I'm real confident about that statistic from Alaska.
Well, ladies, in the time that we do have left, please walk us through the steps of how can we, especially locally in Alaska, get help if we need it, and we need to get that early. So how can a woman get the help she needs?
Well, at Providence Hospital, anyway, if you're here in Anchorage, we have a number of supports available. We have 4 different times during the course of the week, 5 different times actually, where moms and dads of newborns can drop in and have opportunities to connect with other moms, have opportunities to ask questions of experts. and to socialize their kids, to socialize themselves and to socialize their kids. And I think the dad who spoke earlier made a really nice point about educating yourself about what resources are available and what you can expect postpartum. And then Dr. Barnes' point about, you know, families, parents talking about their expectations and sort of having a plan. And a counselor is a wonderful resource to use to help facilitate those kinds of discussions. At Providence, again, we have a family support counseling clinic, which is specifically designed to help families through this transition.
And are there equivalents to that in other locations in Alaska?
You know, postpartum.net is the website for Postpartum Support International. I think that will have that accessible for you online. And postpartum.net is a way that any mom, any family can connect with local resources. So there'll be a map of the U.S. You can click on your state or your region, and you'll be connected with local resources because the groups change quite a bit. But as in my role as statewide coordinator for PSI, I talk with and coordinate care for folks from Fairbanks, from Sitka, from Juneau, from Dillingham. So, you know, we have our own special challenges in Alaska because of the layout of our land here. But that message from PSI that you're not alone, I mean, we really, even in the middle of the night when you feel most alone, we really want moms to know that they are not alone. And we will be here to help, and we will connect them with resources who are going to allow them to be well again. So postpartum.net is a great just kind of first stop for families who are looking for more resources.
And Dr. Diana Lynn Barnes, you have the final word.
Well, thank you. I want to say again and echo what Margie has said, that Postpartum Support International is a wonderful resource and should be the first place that families turn to. I think it's also important that women talk to their doctors during pregnancy about their risks. We know that sometimes we can reduce the risk of having a postpartum depression if only we identify our risks during pregnancy and in many cases even before we conceive. And I think also that Susan Resnick said it best when she said, don't be afraid of what you're feeling. Please don't be ashamed or embarrassed. Don't be afraid to talk about your symptoms and how you're feeling, because that's the most important way to get help. And I think we have to get to a point where the word perinatal mood disorder, the word postpartum depression is just part of the language, just like any other illness, diabetes, cancer, whatever it might be, so that we're not so fearful of these illnesses and we know that we can get well.
Well, Dr. Diana Lynn Barnes and Margie Clifford, I'd like to thank both of you for spending time with us today on Kids These Days.
Thank you for inviting me.
Thank you.
Margie Clifford is Alaska Statewide Coordinator for Postpartum Support International. She's also a counselor in Anchorage. And Dr. Diana Lynn Barnes is a perinatal mood disorders expert, co-founded the Motherhood Consortium, is a doctor of psychology and a therapist. She joined us by phone today from L.A. As is the case, each and every week, we will link you to all of the resources we've mentioned throughout the hour from our website, kidsthesedays.org. You can listen to this program again and share it with others from there as well. Parents of all age kids sometimes feel overwhelmed, maxed out, and finding time to yourself to recharge those batteries can seem too daunting, another thing to squeeze into an already busy day. But for parents, self-care is just as important as childcare. At a recent parent talk meeting held by Thread, parents shared their tips for sneaking some me time into the day, even if it's just in 2 or 3 or 5 minute doses. Our regular contributor, Jessica Cochran, spoke with the guest presenter and some of the participants to share those tips with our listeners.
I'm Alice Hanscom, and I'm a PCI certified parent coach. In order to parent well, you need to take care of yourself first. So if you look at your self-care as a bank account that you're filling up, and if it's full, if it's rich with savings, when you're in a real stressful situation, you now are drawing off of your bank account instead of depleting yourself. The ways to fill up your self-care bank account is to intentionally do things just for you. And a lot of people see self-care as, they have to go out to the Lassa Club for 2 hours, or they have to have lengthy date nights with their husband. And that is all wonderful self-care, but it's really not a reality for many, many parents who don't have that kind of time. So self-care counts, even if you just spend a couple minutes doing something that feels good just to you. The key is to do it intentionally. You intentionally choose to take a longer shower. You intentionally choose to work on a crossword puzzle. You intentionally choose to step outside and drink a cup of tea. Those things all count. They're deposits into your self-care bank account. Yes. They add up, and they're there for you to lean on during tough times.
One thing I think is when we get home from running errands or whatever, and the kids are quiet and kind of content in the car, either asleep or watching a movie or reading books or something, we'll just stay in the car and I'll just close my eyes for a while and just take 5, 10 minutes, 20 minutes if I need, to just take some time for myself before we go back in the house and it's chaotic again.
I get the kids up and get them their milk and something to snack on first thing in the morning, and then I call my mom for my 5-minute pep talk for the day to give me some inspiration and just get prepared to take on the day and know that someone's there and thinking about us the rest of the day. So,
yeah, just the chance to reconnect with a friend and stop and have an adult conversation in the middle of the day, and did a lot to recharge batteries. And so trying to remember to be proactive in doing that more and reaching out to friends.
I exercise, but that's usually not 5 minutes.
If I have extra time to myself, I like to put on actual clothes instead of sweatpants and do my hair, put on makeup, and that would make me what makes me feel good.
To drink tea, to take the time to go and just get my favorite kind, and I always save it for that special moment because it's something that I really like, and just sit and have a nice warm cup of tea. And it's the time I can sit, since it's a hot drink. I don't want to walk around with it with my little guy at my feet, so I'll sit and drink that. It's awesome.
I guess just for 5 minutes, to just relax and enjoy and not worry so much about trying to clean up after everyone, and just kind of relax and be in the moment and try and enjoy that time a little bit more.
Sometimes when life is hectic and my boys are fighting and there's chaos in our house, when I'm at the point where I'm either going to break down or respond unkindly to my kids, I turn on an uplifting song or a song that makes me happy, and then we start dancing and singing to the song instead of, me punishing my kids, how I wouldn't want to when I'm calm. So, music.
I think I liked what she talked about was taking the walk out to the mailbox. I usually wait until my husband picks up the mail, but that might be a good thing to do in the future, is taking those couple minutes and just walking out because it's not too far away and the kids will be fine inside. And also, some physical things around the house that I don't usually do that are, out of my normal, ordinary routine. Like someone said, raking the leaves. That would be something I would enjoy outside get to do. So,
if it feels good to accomplish the laundry, folding some laundry or raking some leaves, if that's what feels good to you, do it. You can take a few minutes to go rake a pile of leaves, and you can feel accomplished, and you've gotten something done, and you've gotten fresh air and exercise. Some people, it is chores. They feel best when they are able to cross something off their list. So if they intentionally choose something that helps them move forward on crossing something off the list, that feels good. You don't have to do a whole basket of laundry at once. That can be overwhelming and stressful. But you can take 2 minutes and see how far you get, and that can feel good.
Jessica Cochran spoke with parents at Thread's monthly Parent Talk meeting. Thread is Alaska's child care resource and referral agency. Kids These Days had help this hour from Juno's Steve Sue Wing. We want to welcome Steve to the KTD team. Steve is a new featured blogger. He'll be writing about his life as a dad in Southeast. Check out Capital Letters at kidsthesedays.org. Of course, we feature other writers on our website as well, so don't forget to read them all. Thread supports our early childhood reporting desk on Kids These Days. Jessica Cochran is our regular contributor, assistant producer, and technical editor. Sarah Gonzalez is our producer, web content editor, and business manager. Lost Lander composed and performed our theme music. I'm Shanna Sheehy. Thanks for spending time with me today, and we'll see you next week.
The ideas, opinions, and commentary you hear on Kids These Days are those of the hosts, guests, and contributors, and do not necessarily represent the opinions of its funders or broadcast partners. The Content Producers Guild is solely responsible for what you hear on the program. Kids These Days is made possible by a generous grant from the Association of Alaska School Boards and its Initiative for Community Engagement. Kids These Days is produced in partnership with KSKA 91.1 FM Anchorage, KRUA, and the UAA Department of Journalism and Public Communications.